Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment in our region as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Coming to Upland December 10th, it's Legends of R&B and Doo-Wop live in concert, including Eddie Holman, The Original Times, Mary Wilson of The Supremes, and tonight's guest, Harold Winley of The Clovers. The Clovers gave us Yes Sir, That's My Baby, maybe the slowest version you've ever heard, also One Mint Julep, Blue Velvet, and they were also the first ones to whom Lieber and Stoller gave Love Potion No. 9. Many other hits of the time with these guys. We'll have more later in the program. We're going to start with Mike Edison, an author whose latest book, You Are a Complete Disappointment, a triumphant memoir of failed expectations. The title really describes what his dying father told him on his deathbed, and it became a look at a rather interesting career and whether or not it was ever, quote, good enough. Emmanuel Rogers has more.
Mike, I have to admit, your book, You Are a Complete Disappointment, hit me pretty hard from the beginning because it's like you just can't imagine someone on their deathbed coming up with saying to their son, you are a complete disappointment, and then going on to finish it with, he has a problem with your watching wrestling.
Yeah, I didn't see that coming, I have to admit. It went down just like it is in the book. I went to see my dad. It was Father's Day. You know, he was sick. He had an oxygen mask on, and he said to me, there's something I want to tell you. There's something I've been meaning to say to you. What, Dad? What is it? You've been a complete disappointment. And it was just this harangue, this salvo, you know, that began just like that, and you're a loser, you're not as smart as you think you are, you're broken and you need to be fixed. And then he ends it up by saying, and I can't believe someone as smart as you likes professional wrestling. And as crazy as it sounds, I know, it's funny, yeah. Is my dad was a snob, and he was very informed by status anxiety and these taste decisions, and the fact that I like professional wrestling. I used to work for a professional wrestling magazine. It was like the first gig I got when I got out of college. I was the editor of this newsstand magazine back in the Hulk Hogan era. Okay. And he was just mortified by this, that someone would find out that his kid was working for a wrestling magazine, because somehow this put a dent in his otherwise perfect preppy Ivy League armor that he liked to wear. That was his gimmick.
It's like, wow, but it's incredible, because I'm thinking, my son is working. All right.
right. You know, exactly. I was marginally but honestly employed, at least.
Yeah.
But the crazy thing was, this was 30 years ago, you know, when I had that job, right? And he's still mad and he's dying. And this is why he's angry about what I watch on TV. But I remember, too, when I was a little kid, well, you always made fun of me watching horror movies. Oh, they're stupid. Reading comic books. Oh, they're dumb. But the wrestling, too. It's, oh, just grow up already. It's fake. I'm like, I'm 8 years old, and believe me, I knew it was fake.
Yeah.
How could you not know it was fake? I was 8 years old, but who cares?
Yeah, really. Yeah.
And that's what you're going to tell me on your deathbed with your last breath. Literally, your last breath, our last moments on earth together. This is the anger you've been holding in your heart of hearts that I watch pro wrestling on TV. I mean, never mind the fact also, though, that I've written many books, that I write about classical music for one of the local newspapers, that I lecture at the library and at universities occasionally. This is what he hung on to. Man, it was unbelievable.
Yeah, but I understand, even though you wrote, you know, and you did all these other things, they weren't approved either.
No. Well, it starts early. You know, I mean, my dad was a narcissist, and he was a bully. And it's sad. I mean, I think, you know, if anyone was a disappointment, certainly it was him. But part of this book is trying to find compassion for him and to figure out why he was so angry. I mean, he never really approved of anything I did, but I wanted to play music, and I had some real good success as a musician in my 20s. We toured the world. We opened up for the Ramones. We were in Tokyo and Paris and, you know, London, not to mention, you know, Seattle and New Orleans and all these great experiences and all the great people that we met. It's fantastic. But to hear my dad say, it was a waste of time, because rock and roll was stupid. He really, really was a snob and very class conscious, and I didn't give him a narrative so he could tell, you know, his friends, I guess, that, you know, how's your son doing? Well, he's playing in a punk rock band in Tokyo. I don't know, if it was my kid, I think that was pretty cool, but my dad didn't really register very well. My brothers, on the other hand, are a Wall Street guy who's doing great, and my other brother's a lawyer, so that's a narrative that he can handle.
Okay, now this is really blowing my mind, because you spoke about your brother in the room with your dad, too, and you actually brought up the way you were dressed and the way your brother was dressed, and how your dad looked at him with approval and looked at you with disapproval. Why was between the two of you this way?
I try to be a mensch. I really strive. You know, you go to visit someone in the hospital, you put a shirt with a collar on. You know, it's just sort of the way I think things should be. My brother shows up wearing, like, you know, Crocs and dirty cargo shorts and like a T-shirt from a rock concert, but he's very successful, my brother. I mean, objectively measured by my father's yardstick, which means he has a job at Wall Street and makes tons of dough. And my definitions of success, for instance, how much time I spend smiling,
right?
You know, how happy I am.
Yeah.
I mean, really, these things aren't things you can put in the bank, so it's not things that he really understands, which is sad, because the book starts out with this, you know, this tragic comic scene, but it ends on a great note that's got a happy ending. And the happy ending is me, because I got to become the guy I wanted to be and not the guy my father told me I should be.
And that's great, because, you know, before we fill our audience eyes with tears and all, I wanted to let them know I found a lot to laugh about in This American Family Tragedy, which is what it is. Why is humor so important in your life?
Well, I think it has to do with living in the moment and being in the present, which is sort of one of the big messages of the book. And it's not humor as a defense mechanism. It's just sort of, I'm enjoying my life, and you should be smiling. You should be laughing. I mean, things are wonderful, and things are comic if you could just see it that way. And unfortunately, my dad never could. I mean, he could never really be in the moment and enjoy the now, because he was always so worried about tomorrow. You know, the comedian Bill Hicks said, if you're living for tomorrow, you'll always be a day behind. And boy, man, that was like my dad and my mom, too. It's like they just lived in fear. They lived in fear of having fun. They lived in fear of being frivolous and letting go, because maybe someone would look at them and they'd be, you know, caught looking silly. But I don't care. I'm having a great time. And that's the humor in it. And, of course, tragedy plus time equals comedy. You know?
Right.
I mean, it wasn't, trust me, it wasn't funny at the time.
Right.
Being in a hospital room, being told you're a complete disappointment. But a few years later, I think it could play on the big screen for laughs.
This is Emmanuel Rogers, and I'm speaking with Mike Edison about the challenges he faced growing up with a parent that he could truly never please. Now, you know, you mentioned your mom, and I would really love to ask you, because what is parental bullying, and how did it manifest in your home, and how did your mom handle it?
She didn't handle it well, to be honest. I think she was a little bit out of her depth, and I also found a lot of compassion for my mom. She was very angry with my father, because he kind of bullied her too with his checkbook,
right.
You know, what he would approve of and what he wouldn't approve of. And it all seemed very much just to stay in power and to be in control. Parental bullying is, you know, it's my dad telling me no, and a culture of no, you can't, and no, you're not good enough, and no, it's a culture of discouragement. And I ended up, you know, on a therapist's couch, not actually on the couch, though I honestly was sorely tempted to lie down, just because that's the way I always pictured it. But it was kind of like The Sopranos. It was kind of like going to see Dr. Melfi. And I said, you know, I don't want to whine too much here. Poor me. Daddy didn't love me enough. And she swore to me, I just, no, this is abuse. You've been told since you were 7 years old that you weren't good enough. You know, when you were 8 years old, you know, that you couldn't play anything. And any time, you know, I couldn't play the drums, I couldn't play the piano, I couldn't play the guitar. And every time that I had a small success, he kind of sabotaged it. I won a photo contest when I was 9. Well, he told me I was no good at it, and, you know, and then he was a better photographer, and I'd have to. It was always competition.
Right.
I mean, it's odd to be in competition with an 8-year-old, right?
Yeah.
But you've seen it a lot, I'm sure, whether it was on a little league field or elsewhere. If I were doing well, I think my dad somehow thought I was undermining him. You know, instead of celebrating my successes, you know, he found them as a threat.
No, wait. Now, did your dad really want to extend his life by having you become that next extension part of him?
Oh, I never really looked at it that way, but he certainly wanted to mold me in his image, you know, which never works. You can't clone yourself. I mean, gosh, okay, anybody seen a science fiction movie that always goes south?
Right?
It's always bad when you try to do stuff like that. I don't know that he was trying to extend his life, but certainly to his vanity and his narcissism, having me being a preppy conservative as he was,
right.
I think was something he would have liked to have shown off as legacy. You know, being me, even who I am, I think, you know, he was in fear of my freedom, because it indicted his system, you know, his concept of how things should go. You go to school, you go to a great university, you get married, you have perfect children, you know, that you can brag about with your perfect friends at the perfect cocktail party, and I didn't fit into that mold.
Wow. Mike, before we move on, will you share with our listeners where they can find more information on the book, Your Complete Disappointment, and your work?
Yeah, well, please visit me at MikeEdison.com, and there's tons of stuff on there. There's some cartoons and comics and some rock and roll music and some other stuff. I've written lots of liner notes for rock and roll bands and stuff. It's all up there at MikeEdison.com.
Now, Mike, by all standards, you did and you do very well as a person on this earth. You're a known, well-known writer, a musician, and your friends really seem to like you. So what effects did your growing up in New Jersey in the 70s and 80s and dealing with your dad have on you?
Growing up in the 70s, I mean, it was such a wide open time to grow up. I was just laughing, you know, the other night how easy it was to get liquor when you were a kid in New Jersey.
Yeah.
You know, you could just write like Wisconsin driver's license on like a piece of paper. And, you know, it would serve a 9-year old, you know, when I grew up. I had no supervision. There was no helicopter parenting.
Right.
You know, my parents were remote and, you know, people were always getting hurt riding their bicycles off of the garage because we watched Evel Knievel on TV. You know, it was a lot different than it is now. But, you know, you learn to take some bumps. You know, got beaten up a couple times, but I know it's cliche, but we don't measure ourselves by how often we get knocked down, but by how many times we get up.
Right.
I'm a writer. Rejection is a big part of my business.
Right.
So, you know, somewhere along the line, I had to get some thick skin.
Man, I am so glad you stuck with watching things such as Creature Features and, you know.
Well, I still dig it, right? I mean, I love horror movies and comic books and Bugs Bunny, you know, and pizza and David Bowie. Yeah. I mean, these are things I still love. I mean, why wouldn't I?
Yeah, do you still eat atomic fireballs?
Absolutely. Of course. my father's like, I'm not trying, because they're too exciting. It's like, please, just it's a piece of candy. You can't fight an 8-year-old because you don't like tasting candy, you know, or what he watches on TV on Saturday mornings.
Yeah.
It's just insanity.
Yeah, I understand you were told at 7 to grow up because of it.
Oh, yeah. 7, grow up already. Grow the hell up. 8 years old, grow up already. Why don't you grow up? Dude, I'm 8 years old.
Right.
I mean, I don't know really what you want me to do at 8 years old, but you can't compare the taste of a 50-year-old man, you know, who grew up in the Eisenhower era with a kid who's 8 years old who's, you know, high on atomic fireballs and listening to Elton John on the radio. It's just, why? Why grow up? And anyway, I don't even know now why anybody, it's not about growing up, it's about evolving.
Right.
You know, I think our generation, like my friends and their kids, they find, you know, they get together because we like superhero movies and, you know, and hip-hop music and the Beatles or whatever it is. It's not no longer a generation gap. It's something that brings us together. But I sort of felt, you know, to my dad when he was born and where I was born, he was of a time when rock and roll was considered some like kind of dirty fad. And it stuck with him, even though he should know better. He was an educated man. There's no reason to, you know, look down your nose. But he was a snob, and that's what he did.
Wow. Well, I can see that by reading your book and looking through your website and all, you're not a snob, and listening to what your friends say to you, it really shows, Mike. But I'd like to ask you just one last question here before we have to go, and that's about your experience as editor of High Times and your experience as a musician. Will you give us just a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, High Times was definitely a case of be careful what you wish for, because the dream job turned out to be kind of a nightmare, herding, you know, stoned cats around an office. I'm actually very pro-pot, but I'm kind of anti-slacker.
Right.
You know, and I'm not really a stoner like that. I love the culture. I love the outlaw culture. I love beatnik culture and hippie culture. And I was born kind of in a great time because I sort of came up with the first wave of punk rock with the Ramones, who we later got to play with and open up with a few times, which was great. But I'm also old enough to sort of have inherited some 60s counterculture. And Kurt Cobain is sort of also a contemporary. It's a nice sort of cultural catbird seat to grow up in. And in New York coming up in the 80s, it was great. We were in the right place in the right time. And, you know, we had a band that was sharp and competitive, and I say competitive in a good way, meaning we rehearsed constantly and really fought to make ourselves known, and it worked. You know, we went to Tokyo and Paris and Amsterdam, Berlin, everywhere.
Wow.
And my dad the whole time told me I was wasting my time. You know? But all the great people that I've met who are still my friends, you know, all these really long-lasting, solid friendships and relationships, my extended family. What do they say? Your friends are the family you choose?
Yes.
I mean, it's totally solid, and I owe a lot of that to rock and roll. And I could just, you know, saying something like that would have blown my father's mind. Owing something to rock and roll? I mean, does not compute.
Right. Well, man, I feel for you as far as your upbringing goes, but I'm glad that you came out the way you did.
Well, thanks, man. The message of the book is, you know, you got to be the person, you know, you want to be, not the person, you know, you were told to be. And for parents, you can't, you know, set these unrealistic expectations on your kids that they can't meet. You know, if your kids are happy and healthy, you know, and kind, I mean, I don't know what else you could really ask for. And, yeah, you know, kids are kids. Teenagers are going to smoke a little dope, maybe, you know, get into a fight. But that's what kids do.
Right.
You know, if they don't miss curfew once in a while, they're just not doing their jobs. But, you know, my folks didn't really see it that way. I mean, you know, they saw me showing, you know, coming home late one night, and they thought that was on the road to, like, a federal penitentiary. You know, clearly not, though. I think we're doing okay. And the happy ending is me.
Yeah.
I'm a really happy cat and very fortunate.
Yeah, and I believe you wrote a book called I Laugh Everywhere I Go.
I Have Fun Everywhere I Go.
I Have Fun Everywhere I Go.
It was my first book, I Have Fun Everywhere I Go. And that book is about my time at High Times and getting that job and about traveling with my punk rock and roll bands. And also I wrote for a lot of girly magazines, Hustler, and I wrote Penthouse Letters and all these things. And this was not sort of the kind of success I think my father embraced. I mean, I did really well, but who's he going to tell?
You
know? You know, what's your son doing? Oh, he's writing for Hustler. You know, we're, again, my other brothers are a lawyer and a, you know, investment banker. That's something you could really trot out at a cocktail party. Me, not so much.
I would have trotted you out a lot as my son, so.
I appreciate it. You can adopt me.
Okay. Well, it looked kind of strange being about the same age, but okay. That'll work.
Sorry, yeah, you got to keep an open mind, and you know, I mean, jokes aside, I mean that is the thing. You got to be open to possibilities, and I think that's a large secret of my happiness is being in the moment, living in the present, but also really being tuned in, you know, to the world. That's part of the secret. There's so much weird, wonderful things happening at all times, and if you could just sort of see past yourself, life is really good.
Yeah, and when you write your next book or whatever it is you're doing, please let us know so that you can come on back and talk with our listeners and me another time. Thank you.
Count on it, man. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Mike.
That was author Mike Edison in conversation with Emmanuel Rogers. His latest book, You're a Complete Disappointment, a triumphant memoir of failed expectations, along with many other links to different parts of Mike Edison's world, simply MikeEdison.com. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Online at KVCRnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Coming to Upland December 10th, it's Legends of R&B and Doo-Wop live in concert, including Eddie Holman, The Original Times, Mary Wilson of The Supremes, and tonight's guest, Harold Winley of The Clovers. The Clovers hit and stayed, for the most part, in the top 5, if not the top 10, on the R&B charts for the first half of the 1950s. What influenced Harold early on was not just R&B, but really everything, anything.
Skylark, have you anything to say to me?
If I go back to those days of 40s, there was a lot of music around, see, but we listened to everything then. See, Bing Crosby was just as big in our house as the Ink Spots were. You understand? Andrew Sisters, Charlie Barnett, all the big bands. And to think of that, Bing Crosby was it, man. You know, and then we had Billy Eckstein, of course. Nat King Cole was doing novelty songs when he came along, you know, Straighten Up and Fly Right and stuff like that. And then we had, of course, the master, Mr. Louis Jordan.
Sure, sure.
So we listened to everybody, man. We would sing, and the Mills Brothers, of course, and, you know, when we heard that they were making those sounds with their mouth, we had everybody walking around doing that. And when I heard the bass, but that was John Jr., the original bass singer, you know, because he died, you know, early, and then Pop came in. They said, that's the old man doing that. And then I started doing that, man. You know, boom, 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 boom. You know what I mean? Because I was influenced by a lot of it. The Delta Rhythm Boys, the Mills Brothers, the Charioteers, the Four Tunes, Steve Gibson and the Red Caps. You know, these are all singing groups. Then we had a very large choir called Wings Over Jordan. A lot of popular singers came out of that choir. You know, there's a song called Sweet Slumber. I think the last person I heard that really did anything with it was Lou Rawls. He really did a good job on it.
Oh, wow.
But the guy that sang that song originally came out of Lucky Melinda's band and Big John Greer. So we listened to everybody, man. Okay. Pat Wilder, oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
It was just that you listened to everything. Everything was open to you, and there was nothing except one song Billy Eckstein had. I'll never forget the day my brother came in the house singing. Billy Eckstein had a song called Jelly, Jelly, Jelly.
Hmm.
And it said, "Jelly stays on my mind. Jelly roll killed my papa and ran my mama stone blind." I said, "Whoa," you know. And then they also had a song called "It Must Be Jam," because jelly don't shake like that.
Yeah, that's right. That's been quoted in current songs.
But you could not do that in 1611 6th Street. Not if my mother was there, or father either. You know, we'd have to be somewhere by ourselves, kids, you know, or over the playground, something like that, singing stuff like that.
Sure.
Definitely not in my house.
Okay.
So we listened to everyone, man, and everybody was walking down the street. We used to call them big boys. The big boys were 12, 13, 14, 15, all up to 18, you know, years of age at the time. And they were singing Billy Eckstine. They were singing Bing Crosby. They were singing Bill Kenny. You could really hear a lot of Bill Kenny around there, you know. And a few of the other singers, Perry Como hadn't shown up in the period that I'm in. Not to me, you know. Fast forward on to the late 40s, you know, then we had Frankie Lane, Victor Moon. You know, Frankie Lane was really hot, man, because he did a song called "That's My Desire," which was a copy of a singer, a piano player, like they had during those periods. You know, there are a lot of ladies that played piano and sang. You know, so he came out singing that, "That's My Desire." Then after him, you know, Mario Lanza. And we listened to all of this stuff, man, you know. Now, this is the beginning of, I said, the early 40s up to around 1945. I was listening to all of this stuff, you know. Then at 45, I lost my parents, and I had to go to North Carolina. And my mother's brother, I was 12 years old. I'd skipped over when I blew my first gig singing in school in the third grade, Miss Smith's class. I was supposed to sing Little Polly Flanders. There was a label of young girls' dresses during that period. Little Polly Flanders sat among the cinders, warming her pretty little toes. Mother came and caught her and whipped the little daughter for spoiling her nice new clothes. But we were going down the steps to the auditorium, or to the assembly area, and I got in a little tussle, you know, like boys just pushing on each other.
Sure.
Just tugging and making a little noise. Mr. Harold, Harold Wendley, you will not sing.
So much for that.
Yeah.
Well, let me see. At some point, you ended up hearing the Clovers. Now, they'd been around for maybe a year and a half or a couple years at the most, but then you heard them on a...
I went to North Carolina in 1945. I was 12 years old. I left North Carolina 3 months in front of my 15th birthday. I went out on my own. I went back to D.C. That's where I'm from, born and raised in D.C. I went back to D.C., got a job. My brother and I had a room. We paid $9 a week for a room. And I was working in a grocery store, and on Sundays, this department store had this amateur hour on, and one of the biggest disc jockeys in D.C. at the time was a man named Jackson Lowe. Jackson played all the music, like most of them did at the time. He played all the music. He played the big band, he played Duke Ellington, he played Louis Armstrong, he played the Mills Brothers, Ink Spots, or whatever was popular. He played everything, you
nice.
Know. This department store, Morton's department store, had sponsored this amateur hour on Sunday to last for 1 hour. So one Sunday, I was working Sunday from 9 to 12 and working, and I think it was 10 o'clock, the show came on. I turned it on this particular Sunday, and I heard this group singing, "Yes, Sir, That's My Baby." I said, "Wow." You know?
"Yes, Sir, That's My Baby. No, man, I don't mean baby."
Yes, I said, "I'm going down there." You know, I got to go down there. Now I went to meet this guy because the harmony just wiped me out. It was just regular four-part harmony, man, but it was so strong, David.
"Yes, man, I've decided."
Went to Camera Music Store and got the sheet music for "Lucky Old Son," which was a hit by Frankie Lane. That was a big record on the market at the time. And I went down, and the next Sunday, and I met him, because if you go down, if you win, you go back the next week and you do another number. The contest ran for 13 weeks. At the end of 13 weeks, you'd have the big sing-off or whatever you're doing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I went back down the next week and I met them. And I sang "Lucky Old Son." I forgot what they sang, but I won. But anyhow, after the show, I invited them into the bathroom. You know, that's where all the groups, right on up there, do waffles. That's what they do, go in the bathroom where the good sound is. That's
sure.
The band, y'all know, Old Man River, by the Ravens. Because I was singing bass. I sang Lucky Old Son, but even the piano player, I can remember him to this day, Jack telling me, he said, both of them named Jack, said, he said, that's too low for you, isn't it? I said, no, it isn't. I sang it. But I sang Old Man River, the Raven style. They jumped on in. The rest of it's history, because they had a bass singer, a very good bass singer named Tommy Woods.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately for me, Tommy Woods' girlfriend didn't necessarily want him just hanging around with those guys. She wanted Tommy to continue work. But none of them guys had a job. I think Buddy had a job, which he quit. And I had a job when I met him, which didn't last long after I met them. McQuaider, who came into the group on a steady base, he was at Howard University. So the boy that he replaced, his name was Billy Shelton. I'm just reading all this history of the group, man. I have no idea. I sang with the Ink Spots for 50 years before I joined the original Clovers. Oh, my God. That makes me 201. But nevertheless, I just kept showing up because they were right in the same area that I worked, the same area that I grew up in, you know? And I was at 6th Street and Q, and they were at 7th and Florida Avenue, and I just kept showing up, man. I just kept showing up.
Yes, sir, that's my baby now.
That's Harold Winley of the Clovers. He'll be in Upland December 10th, along with Eddie Holman, Mary Wilson of the Supremes, and the Original Times. AffordableMusicProductions.com for tickets and information.
We got hooked up into an after-hour place. That's where we woodshed it for about a year or so. Things just happen, man. Now, this is 1949 now.
Sure.
We're singing and we're going around. We're singing the way we could. Well, you know.
Every time it rains, it rains. Then it's from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains? Then it's from heaven.
We go to Hopper every now and then. If the boys didn't run us out of there, we sing, you know. Go, you go to them sock hops, man. They want to hear them records, and we go in there. You know, you go out of one territory to the other. They think you're after the girls. All we want to do is sing, man.
It's upside down.
Baby, don't you know?
Trade them for.
We go to the high schools and we sing outside. Those are high. We go there, and then every year, Armstrong High was a technical school. They had a big program there that I came up on. But the big talent show, man, and it was pretty heavy. You know, it was pretty heavy because you had to be right before they even let you even walk in the door, you know.
Wow.
We never got on that, never tried, actually, but we knew some of the groups that were on there, and we grew up to know those guys later on. The hops, we did the hops, and we'd go to the Elks. He asked nobody for no money. We go to this club and do this and that. Go out to a club over by the parade ground, the Marine parade ground, and we sing and we go upstairs and they stay in the storage room. They bring us some great big ham sandwiches, man. We probably hadn't had one all day. And soda, you know, nobody drinking no beer. At least they wouldn't give you none there, you know. That kind of stuff we were doing, man, until we got hooked up with this place called the Old Rose, which was an after-hour place, speakeasy place from the 30s. And it was still hanging on. And we went in there. And that's where all the performers would come. They worked the Howard Theater in D.C. It's a block away. And all the little hotels and homes and places where the performers would stay. Everything's right there in that area. All the after-hour joints, most of them anyhow, you know. Now I'm looking at a historical thing here, a club called Crystal Caverns in Washington. And I said, oh, my God, they found this picture. This picture was taken in 1938, and the club is still there. Historical landmark now. But nevertheless, we stayed in the Old Rose, man, and we became janitors and everything else. And we just went in and sang. Sometimes we go in there and make money. The blues singer, Wynonie Harris, whenever he come to town, he come right up there, and we sit down and sing to him at his table with his wife. We had a teacher from Howard University. I don't remember his name, but he used to come, he and his wife. They were in their 30s, I think, at the time. And we just sit down and sing to them. Get right at their table and just sing right to them. Everybody has heard it, but we were singing to them.
Yeah, you're right to
he
them.
He would give us $20, man, and say, oh, here comes the old man on the door, because he could see downstairs before they let him in, you know. He said, y'all people are coming. $20, hey, man, that's $4 a piece.
That is a lot of money back then.
That was good. See, but among that group that was in that area was a gambler. They call them sportsmen. DC has some funny laws.
Okay.
So, well, the guys are not paying taxes. So don't call them gamblers. Call them sportsmen. You know, so they said, okay. Then now we met the sportsman. He was, I got somebody I want to introduce you to. And he introduced us to a man named Lou Kravitz. Lou Kravitz was a record salesman. So he was selling Billy Eckstine's label and the Ravens on National and MGM, those two labels. He was out of Baltimore, and he heard us, and he asked us to sing for him. And, you know, he liked what we did. We didn't sing the Mills Brothers, and we didn't sing the Ink Spots. We just sang the Ravens because, I had to do that. He said, okay, we messed around with him for a few months. This thing almost happened overnight. Because in 1948, I came back. In 1950, I'm on a record.
Yeah.
And in 1953, I'm back at the school that I left with the group, and I had a record on the charts with a bullet, as they used to say.
With a bullet, yeah.
Yeah. So we met Lou, and Lou eventually introduced us to Ahmet Erdogan.
Right.
At this big record store of Quality Music on 7th Street in Washington, D.C., Wax Maxie had this store. Great big store, man. I mean, this is a big record store. It was a big to-do when he opened it because he had Paul Williams' band out on the street.
Paul Williams
had that record, The Hucklebuck.
Yeah, yeah.
He had Larry Donnell, which is a dynamic singer, and a girl in the band. And they also had The Hucklebuck and Midget. But this is a little guy used to come out on stage and do his little dance. But okay. And these guys were all friends. So one day, Lou said, we got some people coming up here. I want y'all all here, blah, 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 blah. And it was Ahmet Erdogan and Herb Abelson. We go in the back room of the record store, and we're singing. Well, what are we singing? We're singing How High the Moon, What Is This Thing Called Love. If you're familiar with the Clovers and Clover album,
yeah,
Pennies from Heaven, that's the stuff that we were singing. When they heard us, that's what they heard. And they just listened. Then Ahmet said, I got a song for you guys that I wrote. And he starts singing, Don't You Know I Love You? And we almost fell out. What is this guy doing? You know?
Yeah, I had very specific questions about Don't You Know That I Love You because of Ahmet.
Don't you know I love you, love you. So, and so we're looking at each other.
It's
cool. What is this guy doing? And I managed to be cool. You know? So we didn't sing nothing like that, you know?
Right.
Wynonna Harris might have, you know, or what's the name from Johnny Otis's band? You sing that stuff. But anyhow, he said, yeah, I wrote this. And he gave it to say, I want y'all to sing this for me. And we said, okay. So in a matter of weeks, we had a contract and had a recording date. We had Yesterday's My Baby out there, which did nothing. The guy couldn't get it out the block. We cut that in 1950. We didn't do nothing with it. Okay. But that's still the same song that I heard on the amateur album. That was our very first record.
A slow version of it, too. Very slow.
Yeah, because that was the up-tempo song.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ba-ba, ba-ba-da-da. You know, that's a, you know.
Oh, sure, whether it was a vaudeville.
That's what got me. When I heard Buddy sing that song, I said, oh, my God. And that the falsetto that he used. And so going on from there, you know, we finally cut Don't You Know I Love, went to New York. He gave us Don't You Know I Love You. We had the song Skylark, which was also a big band number and also very popular by Billy Eckstine.
Right.
And that is one of my favorite solo songs for me. But that was it, man. We were at the Royal Theater in Baltimore. Lou Kravitz came to us and said, I got the record. Your record is out. And he brought it to, we went over to a record store and he played us, and we were very, very upset.
Said, upset.
This sounds like us. Man, we told him, said, send it back.
Oh, no.
Because we didn't sound like that. But I'm going with the technology.
Sure.
And what they knew and what they were doing with a vocal group, although they had recorded the Delta Rhythm Boys on some beautiful stuff, background work with Ruth Brown and stuff, just didn't come out to us right. But we just polished it up as we went along, you know, and it worked, man. And right after that, he did Don't You Know I Love You, and then he came back the next time with Fool, 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 Ahmet Erdogan. Quater, the second tenor, and Bill Harris wrote the song to back of Fool, 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 Needless. Rudy Toombs wrote One Man Jewel, Ahmet Erdogan Come Back Again with In the Middle of the Night. This is 1951, Man Jewel was 1952. And we stayed with Atlantic for 8 years, and things were changing, and we weren't. We were still there doing the same thing, but there was some rumbling going on because I could hear things, you know.
Sure.
And then Ahmet just ran out. He ran out of writing stuff that was good, really gone, because we started doing stuff like, after Ting-a-Ling, which was also his, you know, we did Hey Miss Fanny, and I played the fool, which I played fool was the definite type of stuff we wanted to be doing. That is 52, 53 now. This is all in front of Devil or Angel, which became the biggest thing that we had.
Yeah, yeah.
And the interim Bailey was in the Army, and then we had to change lead singers. We had a boy with us that we couldn't use at all. He was a beautiful man, and he covered the spot for a while. And then we got Charlie White.
Okay, there
Stayed with us from the original Dominoes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, Charlie White stayed with us a while, and then we get that Billy Mitchell right at home, a homeboy, you know. Mm-hmm. And that was it, man. Right on up to Love Potion.
That's Harold Winley and the Clovers. He'll be in Upland December 10th along with Eddie Holman, Mary Wilson, and the Original Times. AffordableMusicProductions.com for tickets and information. Just ahead, the Clovers on the West Coast, All-Star Tours, and of course, Love Potion number 9.
I played the fool.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Coming to Upland December 10th, it's Legends of R&B and Doo-Wop live in concert, including Eddie Holman, The Original Times, Mary Wilson of The Supremes, and tonight's guest, Harold Winley of The Clovers. You'll hear about Lieber and Stoller's Love Potion number 9 and more in just a bit, but first I had to backtrack just a bit. I had read that Don't You Know I Love You was the first song of its time to feature a sax solo. And I kind of had to know if this was fact or fiction.
I love you, love you so. Don't you know?
First record that we did, nobody had ever done that. Da 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 da. Yeah, that was Frank Flosho Cully. When they did that, man, I said, oh my God, that sold the record. It was a brand new record when he came in there with that solo. The record was only 3 minutes.
Yeah.
Because the jukebox operators controlled the length of music.
Oh, yeah, they were also short then. My gosh.
Yeah, they want you to play it over and over again. I don't want no song running no 4 minutes and 5 minutes, and they like the stuff like they got now, 7 minutes, 12 minutes. Get out of here. You know, Captain, no, no, no. 315, 320, that's it. But we're the only group that go out on that stage and stay out there a half hour, 4 to 5 minutes, no sing nobody's music but ours. All I wanted to do, I just thank God I'm able to still perform, David, and to see some of the acts. Because actually, when we were out there, the Clovers were out there, none of these people were around. They weren't out there at the time. You know, Irving Fell from Washington, D.C., Super Music, started this stuff with the bus tours when he would bring Frank Avalon, Bob Rydell, too. They used to send them out with the Clovers.
Sort of the All-Star tour.
We used to do shows, but they all see, but this also carried us into another area. But we started working for Fraternal Order of Police, so the Fraternal Order of Police, we used to work a lot for them. But they had Frankie Avalon, Bobby Rydell, Olenka liked the group, and he hired us for a show that he did in Washington some time ago. We were down there for a whole week, man, at Wakata Baron Amphitheater. All in all, the music, the doo-wop groups, as they call them, some of those guys are good, and a lot of them, I hear a lot of them, still today, they sound better than they did when they came out initially. There's a different mindset. Those that are serious, there's a different mindset. It ain't about the girls. Like the guys say, all I want to do is get my hair curled, man. You ain't got to pay me nothing. And in fact, groups like us, we said, when Shaw artists asked Apollo Theater for $25,000 for the Clovers, Frank Sherman said, you got to be crazy. I can get 10 groups right here in New York. They got hits in New York for that. And he was lying, and he actually said that I can get 10 groups, you know, 25,000 now, 10 groups. And all of them got hits in New York. Not known outside of New York, but known in New York.
Right.
But as I stated to you the other day, when I first went to California, man, we started out with Lloyd Price. He didn't go all the way because he went to Korea. But we hooked up with this boy from Memphis, Tennessee, Roscoe Gordon. They had a song, I tell you, No More Dogging, Fooling Around With You. And Roscoe had a good band, and we stayed out there for about a month. It was over a month, actually.
One early morning, as I was walking,
the drink at that time was a screwdriver. I never had, so what you mean a screwdriver? It's, you know, I wasn't really into drinking that much, you know, but they said, oh, you drink this, man. It says orange juice. And then they said, and you can't even smell it. I said, you can't smell it.
Sounds perfect.
Yeah, that was a trip, man.
I don't remember just how it started, but all I know is...
Believe me, I got my butt kicked with a screwdriver, but I let that alone.
Yeah, that happened to me in the Navy.
Working the L.A. area, that area, man, around there, San Diego, and just working in L.A., man, the Shrine Auditorium, you know, Gene Norman, because Gene Norman also did jazz, and he was like a boy that promoted in Detroit. You go to one of his dances, he had us there with the Four Freshmen, the Clovers, and Thelonious Monk, if you know anything about jazz.
Oh, I know Monk well, yeah, yeah.
Well, you put that together.
Wow.
But those are the kind of dances that he gave. The Clovers, James Moody, Charles Brown.
Wow.
Yeah, Frank Johnson. I never forget that, man. And then we worked, like I told you, worked at Club Alabama, man. It was in its death throes, man, but they still had four girls that were still dancing in there. Red Fox had a restaurant around the corner. It had about four stools in it, and it didn't sell nothing in there but steak and salad. T-bone steaks and salad. It had a great big fox painted on the side of the wall around the corner from the Dunbar Hotel. That's where we would stay. And that's where I met Harry Reid and Bobby Nunn.
And now you're talking about early coasters, Robbins.
Yeah. The Robbins, man. But the Robbins were out there first, see, because they were in Vegas, man, when Vegas was a desert. See, we knew about them cats. Because the Fortunes went out there, see, and they come back. They went out there on a handshake and went to work in one of them small clubs and stayed out there 12 years.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
The same thing, 12 years. It's like Fast Domino, you know? But at the time, you know, I was standing at the Dunbar, and I come down late morning, early afternoon, and Herb and Bobby would be there. And we just spent the evening talking and, you know, just walking around talking and blah, 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 you know, sitting in the lobby of the hotel. And every day, once I had to remind her, I ran to him, ran there, I said, now, wait a minute. I said, now, you walking around here platifying and carrying on. I said, now, I remember you from Central Avenue now. And there wasn't no platters. But we always remained good friends, but he became ill. I worked with him about 4 years ago. He didn't even know who I was.
Oh, no.
No, he was very sick. He was very sick. He sat down, he performed, which I do now. He was very sick. But he sang, and he had a very good group, and the group was still working. But that period, going back Central Avenue to Robbins, man, it said, wow. And then Johnny Otis and Little Esther, and that was a heck of a time.
What did you live was the cause of it all?
That's Harold Winley of the Clovers. He'll be in Upland December 10th, along with Eddie Holman, Mary Wilson of the Supremes, and the Original Times. AffordableMusicProductions.com for tickets and information.
I took my troubles down to Madame Ruth. You know that gypsy with the gold captive. She's got a pad on 34th and Vine, selling little bottles of love potion number 9.
Let's jump over then to Lieber and Stoller. I mean, this gave you something great, of course. You guys were the first ones to give us Love Potion number 9. But by this point, Lieber and Stoller were already very well established.
They were established.
Yeah, so did you meet them?
Let me tell you how we got there. Now,
please.
We had October 1958, we went to Italy. McQuaid did not go. The second time, he wouldn't go. Bill Harris, he wouldn't go.
Hmm.
Bill was a guitar player, a teacher, was a classical guitarist, and he also played jazz. To this day, I'll never forget. He said, my son Joseph is 12 years old, and he doesn't even know me. He didn't go. So we carried a piano player, 1958. We stayed over until March of 1959. When we got back to the United States, Lord Price was kicking butt everywhere. We didn't have nothing. We were unknown. Last thing we had that really did anything was The Devil or Angel, and that was passé.
Right.
It was all brand new stuff. And then at the same time, we get off the ship, and that manager comes up and tells us, so you're no longer with Atlantic Records. Okay.
Okay.
We're no longer with Atlantic Records. We never knew what happened. But I know we didn't have no arguments or anything with Ahmet Erdik and them, because we did remain friends. I still get my royalties. And got out making a deal with United Artists. So all we said, all we can do is say, okay. And then they came back before we left New York. He said, I got some stuff from Jerry and Mike. We'd met Jerry and Mike, man, way when they were younger. It's like Sonny Bono used to run around chasing Ryan Sam Cooke there in L.A. trying to get him wrong. Like Paul Anka was chasing us in Canada trying to get us to sing one of his songs.
Okay.
But going back like that. Now, they gave us this song. And so they suggested Billy Mitchell sing it. Okay, Billy Mitchell sang that, and then Buddy Bailey sang the other side, Stay a While. And this was different. And we laughed, it was funny, you know, as the fates would have it, man, that's it.
I held my nose, I closed my eyes.
I took a drink.
I didn't know it was a day or night.
Because that was a record that did not take off.
Not at
it
first.
It made a low noise, and then it went dormant. And in the interim, the group disintegrated, okay? Now, when the Searchers did that, that brought the Clovers back.
64.
Yeah. When the Searchers did that, that brought the name. So, well, that's the Clovers thing, you know, and built up, and right up to right now. I tell young people, ask young people about their song, they know about it. I can ask just about anybody, mostly anybody, I can ask them about Love Potion Number 9. They say, oh yeah, I know that, yeah. The Times-Picayune in New Orleans, when the Saints won the championship, they had a parade in February. It's hanging on my wall right now. The banner with Drew Brees in this fake chair with this fake horse is Love Potion Number 9, Super Bowl MVP, Monday, February the 15th, 2010.
Were you guys at all worried at first about doing a parody-type song? Because you'd been doing pretty music and some R&B stuff, fun stuff, but never what I would call a parody tune. Did you guys worry about this at all, or was this just, hey man, this is fun, let's do it?
No. If we were given material, we tried to do it. Don't care what it was, we tried to do it.
Down in the alley, just you and me. We're going balling till 3:30.
One thing I say about the original group, I can say that we go on stage and we're not going to sound the same way always, you know. Like I may have a group that recorded some songs. I can take one arrangement and sing their whole set, sing their whole show.
Yeah.
Not knocking them, but that's the way it is.
Yeah, right.
And people want to hear that again. There's the catch right there. That's what they want to hear. They can identify with that.
Mm.
But we sang all different styles of songs.
Well, that
funky blue down in the alley. And one funky in that, Wonder Where My Baby's Gone. And then a pretty song, right on the back of Miss Fanny, I Played the Fool. Blues ballad, man.
That's when I'm missing your kind of kissing down in the alley.
And then we did a lot of drinking songs, Crawling. The college crowd, they like that. I got a buddy man in Valdosta, Georgia, I met at University of Georgia, 1954, and we're still friends. In contact daily almost.
Nice.
Yeah, that class had us there for 4 years. Class brought us there and we worked until they graduated. But what about Blue Velvet, man? You know, that's
a beauty as well.
Yeah, Blue Velvet, which is a beautiful song. You know, Arthur Price song, but we got it from Tony Bennett in 1951. That song was written. Beautiful song, man.
That's always been beautiful. I don't care who does it.
And the group that I have now, we sang that. I do this updated arrangement, but I keep the original candy. I mean, I've been around long enough to know. A buddy of mine, a 35, 40-year friend of mine, said, if I didn't know this song, I didn't recognize it. I said, come here, I want you to go in my room and say that again. I wanted these young boys to hear that, that they wanted to change, you know, they want to change this, change that, you know. So now listen, here's a man, you go to his house, his name is Larry Hyder. David, from the floor up to the ceiling almost in his house.
Mm-hmm.
78 records.
Oh my goodness.
In one room in his house, almost to the ceiling. Now this man is an authentic collector.
Yep.
He ain't no fly by night. He knows exactly what he's talking about.
Wow, nice.
I said, now y'all listen to what this man say. I want you to understand that. When I say no, man, if you want to do something else, you know, go somewhere else and do it. But we can remain friends, but this is about business, and this is about giving the people what they want to hear.
That's Harold Winley of the Clovers. We spoke a bit more, but that's a good place to leave it. Bringing the music you want to hear. Harold Winley and the Clovers will be in Upland December 10th, along with Eddie Holman, Mary Wilson of the Supremes, and the Original Times for Legends of R&B and Doo-Wop Live in Concert. AffordableMusicProductions.com for tickets and information.
And I still can see blue velvet. I still can see blue velvet through my tears.
That's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Harold Winley and to Nathan Gothels with Affordable Music Productions. Thanks also to Emmanuel Rogers with his interview of author Mike Edison. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Lindsay Boyd, and General Manager Alfredo Cruz. Beyond the music of the Clovers, music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts, behind us now, for example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can find past KVC Arts programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.